Good afternoon. You're listening to Praxis. You're on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. I'm your host, Taylor, and today I'm going to be live on the phone with someone who is coming to town later this week for a great event. I'm just pulling up that phone, and I should be on with Pastor Terry Kylo. Terry, can you hear me out there?
I sure can.
Great, and I can hear you, so that's good news. So if you wouldn't mind, I haven't said much about the event that's happening this week yet, and I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about the roadshow that you're on, who you'll be here with, and what folks can expect?
Yeah, sure. So the roadshow is called the Faith Over Fear Roadshow, and my friend Anila Afzali, who's a Harvard-trained lawyer and a Muslim activist, from the Redmond and Seattle area. And I've been doing we've now done 25 of these roadshows across the state, many of them in more rural areas, but also some in some more urban areas, trying to help people, A, first meet a Muslim, and B, understand the anti-Muslim bias that is sort of baked into the cake of this country, to understand the anti-Muslim hate groups that are basically infecting our political life and dividing us from one another and what we can do about it. And we do that show in about 2 hours, and we do some live Q&A as part of that so that people can get their questions answered.
That's great. So the one here is going to be Thursday, October 3rd at 6 p.m. at the Wolf Auditorium out at Gonzaga for folks listening. It is free of charge, I believe.
It certainly is.
Okay, great. Education, accessible. Good. We love that. So I guess just to back up, can you share a little bit about yourself and your own journey into this work as a pastor and just as a person?
Yeah, so I grew up in La Crosse, Washington, which is south of Spokane, about 80 miles. And when I grew up, there was only one person of color in the community. And I should say that I grew up, you know, with kind of a form of white supremacy that basically believed that white people were more important than others. And I remember even being out at church and hearing, after we had sung the song, you know, Jesus Loves Little Children, that I went up, I got older, I heard some of the men in the parking lot, you know, using racial slurs. And upon reflecting on that, I realize now that if you benefited from the land that was taken from the native peoples of this country, if you benefited from them, you kind of have to dehumanize them a bit. And once you dehumanize one group, you can move on to another and to another.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've kind of gone on a journey myself, moving to Tacoma to do schooling, moving to Chicago to go to seminary, meeting a whole lot of different folk. And about 7 years ago, I met a Muslim man. And we began to do some dialogue and then some interfaith dialogue with a Buddhist. And then eventually we were invited to a military town on Whidbey Island to kind of counter some of the anti-Muslim bias there. And it was kind of an amazing evening. About 90 people showed up. It was very powerful. I didn't know what I was doing, but my Muslim friend was great. And we did like 4 or 5 more of those. And then after the Paris attack, my friend was telling me about all the microaggressions and the aggressions and vandalism that was happening at Muslim-owned businesses, what school kids were facing. And we both decided to put on a larger event in Lynnwood. And this is in December of 2015. And in between announcing that event and it happening, the San Bernardino attack happened, and then Donald Trump announced that that he wanted a complete and total shutdown of all Muslims coming into the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had 450 people come to this event. We had media. We had to have police because there was a lot of tension in the air. And the event went really well. And the next morning, I got emails from pastors all over Western Washington asking if we could host an event, like put on an event like that at their place. And so, you know, I'm a Lutheran. I know what Lutherans did and didn't do for our German Jewish neighbors, you know, mm-hmm. in the 1930s and 40s. I know the courageous acts that some Lutherans engaged in, and I know that a lot of Lutherans didn't know their Jewish neighbors and didn't stand with them. And so it was really kind of a gut check for me. Like, am I just going to have put on one nice event, or am I in it for more? And so I began this journey and got so busy putting on events and hosting conversations and helping people to sort of calm down and get to know their Muslim neighbors that I actually had to resign from the churches I was serving in order to do this essentially full time. And I've been doing that now for about 3 years.
Wow. And that's through Neighbors in Faith.
Yeah. So I started that organization basically without knowing where my money was coming from. I just knew I had to do it. Mm-hmm. And I've had a lot of good support from the Lutherans and Episcopalians and Methodists and Presbyterians and Unitarians. And there's been Latter-day Saints churches that have been very helpful and supportive. I've had some atheists and agnostics be supportive. I mean, it's been really great. And we've now done, at this point, I've done 65 major public events around the state. And again, many times in smaller communities. And then I've done another, you know, something on the order of 200 other either sermons or classes or presentations or trainings, often with Muslims, but not always, to try to create more allies for our Muslim neighbors and help them understand how to be good allies.
Mm-hmm. And so having done all these events and then looking toward this one, this is the first time that you're touring kind of east of the Cascades, is my understanding.
So we have done Yakima.
Oh, okay.
And we did one in the Tri-Cities. We did a very small one in Moscow, Idaho, with the student association.
Oh, cool.
There, the Muslim student. And then we did go to the PGILS conference last January when it was all nice and snowy. And we had a good time meeting a lot of those folk there. But we're really trying, after kind of a little bit of a break, you know, because these road shows take a lot out of you. There's a lot of emotion, and mm-hmm. There's people in the crowd that are very angry and afraid, you know. So after a little bit of a break, we're starting up again. And we're going to be going to lots of different communities, trying to go to Walla Walla, go back to Pullman, maybe go to Colfax, Moses Lake. We want to go to Wenatchee. And then on the western side of the state, we want to get out to Port Angeles and Aberdeen and get out to some of the smaller communities, because the problem is that Muslims make up about 1% of the population, but mm-hmm. they're very highly concentrated in urban and suburban areas. So the reality is that most people in most counties have never met a Muslim, and so all they know of Muslims is what they see in the news, what they see in the movies, what they see, you know, from political candidates and in evening, you know, dramas. And so a lot of them are understandably afraid.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So what, I guess, you touched on it a little bit talking about the past tours. I guess I'm really curious, what's something that you hear over and over again from participants in these talks? And what's something that's surprised you over the time that you've been giving them?
Yeah, so, oh my goodness. So we first of all, we always get 4 questions. And that was part of what drew me into this, is that I realized that everywhere I went and I did a presentation and we had Q&A afterwards, there was always 4 questions and they were almost always framed the same way. And the topics of those questions are Islam and women, Islam and peace, Islam and democracy, Islam and other religions. So everywhere we go. And those questions, those issues kind of get framed, you know, in about 15 or 20 different ways. So the questions sometimes vary, but we're almost always asked something about, say, Sharia. And people like they think they know what it is. Or from more progressive folk, we tend to get questions around Islam and women, where it's assumed that wearing a hijab is somehow inherently oppressive.
Mm-hmm.
One of the, and of course, in our roadshow, we respond to those 4 issues. And further, you know, especially in the Q&A, but in our presentations we do as well, both trying to model for allies and for Muslims, but also to respond to people who are persuadable but are still kind of afraid. The thing that was super surprising to me when I went out to these, and this has maybe happened, you know, I don't know, I bet you a quarter of the time, someone walks up to me very kind, very gentle person. They walk up to me and they tell me that it took an act of courage for them to come because they were so afraid of Muslims that they thought they might be harmed.
Wow.
And that's it's just amazing to me to see that level. And so part of what all of this has come to understand is that the hate groups that generate fear and hatred toward Muslims and other groups too, politicians that do that, media sources and entertainment media that do that, are not simply creating an oppressive atmosphere toward Muslims. They're actually lodging fear in the heart of everyday American human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of our work is to help them become free of that fear so they can begin to recognize, and this is why we came up with the term, their neighbors. And if they have a faith tradition, like, you know, a lot of people are Christian, not everybody certainly, but if they're Christian, they can begin to understand Muslims as their neighbors in faith, as people who they can watch different shows and have different beliefs and root for different teams, but you can also ask for a cup of sugar if you need it.
Mm-hmm. And to see the similarities, right? I mean, even theologically, yeah, historically, all of those four questions you presented could be fairly posed toward Christianity as well, right? I mean,
yes, indeed. Yeah. And not just historically, but in our current present moment,
mm-hmm,
you know, as someone who, and often I quote actually George W. Bush, former president, by saying that we often judge others by their worst actions and we judge ourselves by our best intentions.
He said that?
You know,
wow.
Yes, he did. He said that in an event in Dallas.
Okay.
After someone had engaged in some ideologically motivated violence.
Hmm.
So, and that's me trying to reach out and make sure that we're messaging and speaking to,
sure,
people across the ideological spectrum. As we do that kind of messaging, mm-hmm, and of course to Christians, then I would say, well, you know, it's important to take the log out of our own eye before we try to take the speck out of somebody else's.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, one of my tasks as a pastor in these kind of conversations is to remind people about, you know, the human problems that all communities share, including those that have high aspirations, like you know, Christians and Muslims and our Jewish neighbors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what has, I guess I'm also curious, I'm curious about a lot with this work, but
sure,
when we talk about allyship, I think there's some really, yeah, interesting and complex conversations going on around that right now.
Oh, man.
Something we talk,
man,
about on the show.
yeah.
What have you learned and from being, I mean, you're not acting as a representative of the Muslim community. Obviously,
no,
you're going around with Anila Afzali.
Exactly.
But what has that looked like? What has that dynamic looked like between the two of you and kind of between these two,
yeah,
communities?
Well, I really love that question. And I just want to say, Taylor, that I still have a lot more to learn. Like, mm-hmm, this is so complex. I want to say that at first, like, you know, there was a little bit of like, you know, I've come to love a lot of Muslims and I'm not going to let them just get bullied around. Right. And that comes from real deep in me. You know, I almost tear up when I say it even right now. So there is kind of an urge to protect and stand beside and help. But that urge, you know, can very easily become about the person being an ally,
mm-hmm,
and not become what actually might help our Muslim neighbors. And so what I try to do is use my cisgender white person, a white Christian pastor wearing, you know, black shoes and a clergy collar and, mm-hmm, a suit, use that privilege to create space for Muslim voices. Because I can find a place to speak anywhere in almost any community in the state. There's somebody there who will invite me in.
Mm-hmm.
And then I bring Muslims with me and I introduce and I step out of the way. And they speak. And that's what's transformative. And then I can come beside and then repeat some of the same things, share some things from the Christian perspective and from the American perspective, frankly, about why it's important to stand with our Muslim neighbors. But then here's two key points. First is that when Anila and I or myself and other Muslims are engaging in Q&A, it's always we have to use a lot of care in who answers the question, who answers first, who answers second, sometimes, and it's always got to be, in my mind, even in my instincts, I'm trying to think about how can I best support my Muslim neighbor, and sometimes that's by not speaking at all.
Mm-hmm.
So what we were in Spokane for the Bar Association meeting, and I was answering questions with another lawyer that I work with sometimes, who's a public defender in Seattle. And a question was asked about the hijab and dress codes for women. And she, of course, as is appropriate, answered that question. But as an ally, it was my responsibility, I thought, to answer the bias behind the question and to state that men also have a dress code in Islam,
mm-hmm.
which almost nobody in the room knew. And then every time I get through it with an event, and I work with many, many different Muslims across the state, but especially with Anila, every single time, you know, we get together afterwards and do a debrief, and this is my question. Did I do something or say something that disadvantaged you today? And I want to say that it, like the first, especially 30 times I did this with Muslims, the answer was always yes. Yes, you did.
Mm-hmm.
And then here's what you did.
Yeah.
You know, and I just want to say, like, I think part of being an ally who intends well includes the necessity of feeling pain. Like, you've got to love enough to be willing to hurt.
Yeah.
And every single time they told me that I screwed up in some way, like, it hurt bad. But then, you know, but then I would learn and grow and read more and understand more. And, you know, and now it doesn't happen too often,
mm-hmm.
you know. But I always ask the question anyway, because Muslims know, like, inherently living in this country, like, all of the pressures and oppressions that are on them.
Mm-hmm.
I can study it. I can have empathy and compassion for it, but I don't know it. The reality is I can take my collar off and take my neighbors and faith badge off my chest and go into Safeway and nobody knows.
Mm-hmm.
But my Muslim friend, you know, Anila, when we leave an event, like, you know, she walks into Safeway and she may have someone yell at her for wearing a hijab.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's about kind of understanding your place, being willing to learn, being willing to hurt, and just keep inviting that process of listening,
mm-hmm.
In a way that the people you're allying with trust you to be willing to learn.
Sure. And I think even the process of you initiating that by asking, is an important step, because, you know, maybe if you hadn't done that after the 15th time you screwed something up, they might have just stopped doing it with you, and you might have never known what had happened, and this partnership would have ceased, and you would have been able to make up your own story about why, you know. And I think that happens all the time.
Right.
Yeah,
I think it does too. And I, you know, and so and part of it would be that it would be easy to be grateful for what I'm doing, you know. Well, at least he was trying, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is, we want to actually change hearts and minds.
Mm-hmm.
We want to actually change the condition of Islamophobia or anti-Muslim bias. We want to build more allies, and allies that know how to respond to questions in a positive way and not get trapped in the negative framework of the questions. And doing that is an art, and there's a little bit of science to it. And I think what I want to say about that, too, is you only always have a batting average.
Mm-hmm.
There's never been one event where I said, well, I nailed that one. Not one, you know, at all.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS. I'm talking by phone with Pastor Terry Kylo. I'm getting your last name right, correct?
Yeah, you did.
Okay,
you did
good, yeah. Good. Okay, just making sure. He'll be here along with Anila Afzali from MAPS, and he is joining us from Neighbors in Faith. There's a lot of co-sponsoring organizations on the event I'm looking at. But they'll be here Thursday night, October 3rd at 6 p.m. at the Wolf Auditorium at Gonzaga. And I have that Facebook event linked on my show page at facebook.com/PraxisRadio, PraxisRadio. So I'm really interested to hear, I'd love to ask you a little bit about a language question. Because you just said Islamophobia or anti-Muslim bias, and I see both of those,
yes,
both of those on your materials when I was reading up online.
Yeah,
can you speak to that a little bit, and even just the characterization of anti-Muslim bias as a phobia?
Yeah, right. So, when I first entered into this kind of field, the term of the trade, countering anti-Muslim bigotry and bias was Islamophobia, and it still is, really. Recently, some of the anti-Muslim hate groups, and especially some of their Christian allies, have been pushing back on Islamophobia, as if to say that it's not a phobia if there's actually a threat, right? And so when we go to more conservative places, possibly, or places where folk haven't met as many Muslims, we tend to shift into anti-Muslim bias instead of the term Islamophobia,
mm-hmm.
because it says essentially the same thing, but it isn't quite as, we don't get the negative reaction immediately from some folk that might be experiencing fear, and so right now, like Anila and I are actually trying to figure out if we should get rid of the term Islamophobia altogether. Like we're just really wrestling with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure where we're going to come down yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it is something more than, it's not fear, but it's something more than that. I think as well.
Yeah. I think it's put in with a second term, which is the Islamophobia industry.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, is a somewhat pejorative, framing of about 30 to 40 main anti-Muslim hate groups in the country who make Americans afraid. And they actually are very effective at it, as it's always easier to create fear than it is to create trust or love, and they're backed up by a whole lot of other organizations and politicians. And so the Islamophobia is then created by the Islamophobia industry in part. And so the terminology is never perfect. Anti-Semitism is not a perfect term either.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes movements just kind of get stuck with these terms.
Yeah.
And we have to figure out, how to move forward.
Mm-hmm. So, which brings us to, you cite in the description for the event, it cites this figure, mm-hmm. $30 million a year spent by anti-Muslim hate groups. Can you kind of unpack that a little bit for listeners and talk about who some of these groups maybe that they have heard of might be and those they might not have heard of?
Yeah, sure. So a resource that people can go to is www.islamophobianetwork.org. .com. Islamophobianetwork.com. And there they can read a report that was done looking at the publicly available record of these organizations. And in that report, they describe that there's about 34 major ones, that many of them started around 2008. And they spend a lot of money, probably closer to $40 million a year. We're trying to be a bit conservative, so we're clear. And we're well within the truth. But one group a chapter was started by Representative Matt Shea in the Spokane Valley is called Act for America.
Mm-hmm.
Bridget Gabrielle is the one that started that. I have a photo in my presentation of her standing in the front porch of the White House. And so these groups are really wired in another with our national security sort of apparatus. one group, especially the Center for Security Policy, it's called, had actually Mike Pompeo on a number of their radio shows, who is our current Secretary of State. Act for America gave Mike Pompeo an award in 2016. And when, during his confirmation hearing, Senator Cory Booker asked him about his connection to these, you know, Southern Poverty Law Center identified hate groups, and the Anti-Defamation League also calls many of these groups hate groups as well. Hate Watch does as well. When he asked Mike Pompeo if he would, you know, step back from his relationship to these organizations, Mike Pompeo was unwilling to do so. John Bolton recently, you know, resigned as National Security Advisor, actually ran an anti-Muslim hate group called the Gatestone Institute. And you will, once in a while, see the Gatestone Institute put up little news stories that show up on my iPhone from time to time. So it's fascinating. So these groups get their funding a lot from, A, true believers, you know, and sadly, some Christians who really believe that Islam is some kind of threat. And number two, we get people who own stock in the military-industrial complex, and who realize that if we can scare Americans like crazy about 1.8 billion Muslims on the planet, that we can sell more bombs and more guns. And so there's just a lot of money flowing to these folk because people are making money on the, you know, after the fear is produced.
And yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned the military industrial complex. I mean, I think you have to in this conversation, but I think that Islamophobia and anti-Muslim bias, even for very well-meaning people, has served to kind of like flatten a whole region and series of regions that we're involved in, because we can kind of group and other everyone who we believe lives there, even though a wide variety of people live in the wide variety of places that the U.S. is involved. And then what about, I mean, you talked earlier about entertainment media. There's kind of a soft, it's not as overt as a group like Act for America, but how do these biases then kind of just like propagate through other media, maybe in a less organized fashion?
Sure. So, you know, you have them. So, you know, these hate groups, like, they actually do messaging studies. So the term Sharia law is a term that they put the word Sharia and law together. Sharia is just a word for Islamic teaching. It means, actually, its original wording, its original usage was a path to water, you know, which is necessary for life, especially in a desert community, you know. And so they put the word law together with the word Sharia, the word law, kind of compulsion and the police officer pulling you over, that sort of thing. And they found that that was very successful at scaring people. And so that messaging study then gets shared by tons of Christian bloggers and pastors across the country. It gets shared by about 40 or more major news sources. But even news sources that a lot of, like, you know, progressive people read or listen to are also in on it, not necessarily as badly or as blatantly, but, you know, how often, like, say on NPR, do they actually have, like, real live Muslims responding to these questions? Not very often. A study was done by 416 Labs that found that the New York Times used adjectives and adverbs that were more harsh toward Muslims and Islam than toward cancer or cocaine.
Wow.
And so the reality is that we have kind of a national narrative that is told either in hard ways and really, you know, hard exclusionism, or told in softer ways that kind of ultimately supports that exclusionism by a lot of more what are supposed to be more even-handed, you know, or even left kind of leaning media outlets. So it's really super fascinating. And then a man did a study on movies, and he found that of the 1,000 films in the last century that had Muslim characters, only 12 of the depictions were positive, and 56 were neutral, and the rest were negative.
Wow.
So if you're just watching, you know, and then another study was done by a group called Media Tenor, and they found that on CBS, NBC, and Fox News, 50% of the news coverage was about Muslims, and only 5% of it was positive.
Wow.
You know, so you're your regular everyday person, you know, coming home and turning on, you know, the news, and what are they going to see? You know, they're going to get this impression. And then that impression is confirmed in when they watch a movie, and it's confirmed by a politician, it's confirmed by their pastor.
Yeah.
Well, of course, they're going to think that they've got it all figured out, and then fear is going to, you know, basically sit on their, you know, sit in their, on the throne of their heart, mm-hmm. you know, and that's not good for them, and it's certainly not good for our democracy.
Mm-hmm. And I gotta say, I'm not as familiar with this specific topic as I probably should be, having done a lot of anti-racism work. So
sure.
I think in a lot of ways, anti-Muslim bias, Islamophobia overlap with kind of, I guess we'd say, like traditional anti-Black and white supremacist racism.
No, but,
what would you say are some key things that people might not understand initially that make them not identical?
Well, so, you know, we all have benefited from, and I'm forgetting her name at the moment, who came up with the term intersectionality.
Kimberly Crenshaw.
Yeah, this is so awesome. Especially when people use the term correctly, the way she intended. And so many Muslims in this country are immigrants. Many of those immigrants are perceived, you know, to be people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden they're wearing, they may wear clothing that's of some sort of traditional religious clothing, or clothing just from their homeland, their home country. And then they're perceived to be practicing Muslim. And part of that, of course, is that, especially in the western part of the state, that they're perceived to be practicing, like, you know, they practice a religion. And some people think poorly of that, you know, which I can understand, given the hypocrisy of many, many people of faith. Like, I mm-hmm. get that. And so it really adds up with them. And if you add, you know, if you add being female to that, it just keeps going. So it's another layer. So we were at a conference of judges, and the questions there were like way better than the normal questions we get, and they were just as bad, because there were questions like, it looks to me like Islam is foreign,
mm-hmm.
which is really an odd question. Like that is like systemic. That to me was an expression of systemic racism and religionism. Because here we had an assumption that A, Islam has not been around very long in this country, which is not true, since Muslims have been here from the very beginning, fought in the Revolutionary War, and 30% of the Africans brought here, you know, forcibly from Africa, were in fact Muslim. And so, so I think all of the categories of intrapersonal racism, interpersonal racism, institutional racism, and structural racism apply to Muslims. They just have like another layer of mm-hmm. intersectionality on top of that.
Yeah. And I think also folks who are, you know, in the dominant systems of education and religion and upbringing in general, and who are white, I mean, mm-hmm. myself included, I literally like have spent a ton of my life learning like left politics, hidden history and everything. And this is the first time I've ever considered the fact that many enslaved Africans must have been Muslim. Like,
yeah. And you know,
it's just never a part of the narrative.
No, it isn't. And then what we got to understand. So like, if we're talking about like institutional and structural racism, so my friend Mohammed went through the border crossing, you know, north of Seattle, north of Bellingham, and he came back through, and they thought that he was Mexican, because he kind of passed for a Mexican person. and from a certain region. And so he was sitting there in the chair, and the guy looked down at his driver's license and got so nervous he dropped it on the floor. Came back 40 minutes later, and the man said to him, you know, you're okay. We checked you out, but really you should consider changing your name.
Whoa.
Or another another data, like from a 2017 study, found that 42% of Muslim kids experience bullying in schools. 25% of the time, it's by a teacher or an administrator. And just imagine what that sort of, you know, institutional and verging on systemic racism and religionism does to that family and to that community.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's many more things. Like another piece that's like really, really critical is that the average sentence sought against a person when they're perceived to be Muslim is four times longer than someone who does a similar crime but is perceived not to be Muslim. And the average sentence that's given to someone who is found guilty is five times more if you're perceived to be Muslim than if you're not.
Hmm.
Which means that you know, that significant human rights and equal protection under the law are being denied our Muslim sisters and brothers. And so it isn't, so there are, you know, racism in all four of its quadrants, you know, is taking place. And there's not a Muslim that I've ever met who's ever said that they don't have to work through some issues with regard to how they see themselves or how they see their faith tradition based on the dominant culture's narrative about them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so when I first began the work, you know, in 2015 especially, it was really hard. And this is kind of some good news here. It was really hard to get Islamic centers and mosques to kind of go public and say, hey, we're here. We want to meet our neighbors. We want to form partnerships with Jewish communities and Christian communities and Hindu and Buddhist and atheist and agnostic groups. Like, it was really hard to get them to come out because, of course, they were experiencing oppression. The good thing that has happened in the last 3 or 4 years is that they've begun to see, at least over here, that they've got friends. They have allies that will stand with them. And one of the most beautiful things that happened, after the Christchurch, shooting, you know, it was so horrific. We actually had, I think, 2,500 people show up at the Muslim Association of Puget Sound in solidarity with the Muslim community. And there were lots of rabbis and pastors and Buddhist monks and just everybody you could imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that terrible thing happened at Easter, and, you know, some folk, you know, walk into a church and do the same sort of thing, we had, we kind of participated in bringing people to the Roman Catholic cathedral in Seattle. And the Muslim community showed up, and they brought flowers, and they gave a little bouquet of flowers to every Christian that was there. And every time they said, we're sorry that this happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that has begun to happen more and more and more. And there's people engaged in partnerships and working on issues in their local community. It's really quite beautiful. Working across so that Muslims are understood to be standing with our Latinx neighbors, are standing with lots of other marginalized groups when they need support, and it's really beautiful to see that kind of movement emerging and strengthening right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS. I'm talking with Pastor Terry Kylo by phone. He will be here on Thursday, October 3rd, along with Anila Afzali, to talk about neighbors in faith, to talk about promoting specifically Christian-Muslim dialogue, but dialogue across all groups regarding anti-Muslim bigotry and bias. So again, that Facebook event is linked on my Facebook page, which is at facebook.com/PraxisRadio, PraxisRadio. And you can also search Bridges Not Walls Spokane, which is one of the co-sponsoring organizations who has it posted there. So Terry, we've got like 10 minutes left, and I wanted to make sure that we, I mean, I think all the work is positive, but I think it's easy to kind of lean into to all of the things that are wrong that, that constitute why this issue is worth working on. But one thing I'm curious about is having done a lot of anti-racism work in progressive communities, sometimes the racism that takes place in progressive communities can be more insidious in a certain way than it is in a more openly, like more comfortably a community that doesn't believe itself to be not racist has a different belief about that. What are some ways that you think folks who might be listening, the base of the show is largely quite progressive to radical, who might have some unchecked anti-Muslim bias of their own, how might that be appearing for them? And what would you recommend people do? What questions can people ask themselves? How can people start to do the inner work on that?
Right. Yeah. So part of it is, part of the source of some of it is an anti-religious sort of bias in some of Western culture that basically blames religion for all sorts of problems, as if religion is uniquely part of that. And it's a whole complicated, you know, kind of topic that deserves about 18 hours by somebody smarter than me. But you know, we had one of the least religious centuries in the history of the world in the last century, and 262 million people were murdered in genocide and mass violence. And so sometimes religion just kind of gets blamed for stuff. And that I think isn't quite fair, like for human problems. You know, violence is a human problem. I think religion can be a particular attempt to tamp it down and to help people see other people as human. I think that's actually what monotheism was intending to do, to say that group over there, even though they speak differently and eat differently and worship differently, they're still human because there's one creator that unites us, right? Mm-hmm. That's what it's trying to do. I think a lot of Christians kind of go the other way and say, well, you're not really human unless you believe like us. And that is very arrogant and I think exclusionary. And that does lead to violence. But then I've met people who are anti-religious that basically say, you're not really a human being if you're religious, you know. So it's the same kind of human tendency to otherize people coming through. The primary issue that we hear from progressive folk is around Islam and women, and especially around like Saudi Arabia not allowing women to drive until recently, or the notion that women are forced to wear the hijab, as if men aren't. But the reality is that Islam, in 1400 years ago, created a package of rights for women that were unparalleled until very recently. Women were allowed to own property. They were given the right to divorce. They were given a share of the inheritance, about one third. And that doesn't sound fair, except that the women were not asked to contribute to the ongoing expenses of households. Hmm. So women could have a job. They could earn money in any way that they wanted to. And they served in leadership positions in Islam, in Islamic countries. We actually have across the world, majority Muslim countries. There are nearly 50 of them that have had female heads of state. We haven't managed that here yet. I hope we will soon.
Yeah.
You know, and so women were actually given this sort of this economic advantage to be able to build up generational wealth to equalize the times when patriarchy completely ruled everything. And so people just don't know this about Islam. I know a woman who became Muslim because of the hijab, because it was her way to say that her body belonged to her. And look up here at my face. Like that's the way she talks about it. It was a way to it was really intended as a as a way to help people like recognize the full humanity of the person and not to be focused on checking them out, mm-hmm. so to speak. I think another whole piece is do Muslims like want to require everyone to be Muslim? And the answer is in Islam that there is no compulsion in religion. That even God does not use compulsion to make people believe one way or another. That is the individual choice of the human being. And in fact, there are other passages that talk about if you have a difference with someone, you just say unto me my religion, unto you your religion. Like, let's like be human together, mm-hmm. And if we disagree about some stuff that we can't figure out, like, and actually there's other passages that say, let's let God figure that out later. That's not our problem right now. And so just like we, it's not quite right to blame all Christianity for the KKK. It's also not right to let the Taliban or ISIS or whatever be the spokespeople for an entire religion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to say that, like I've claimed, I think in my earlier part of my story, that there's a certain kind of white supremacy that much of Christianity in this country has been filtered through. And I think that there are many Christians, both in the pulpit, like myself, but who are trying to repent of that and trying to work to change that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still not quite right to like use anti-Christians to explain Christianity. And it's also not quite right to let anti-Muslims or people who are violent criminals be the ones that we go to for our source about this tradition,
mm-hmm.
which really has very deep similarities to Judaism and Christianity, that basically says there's two primary things. One is loving God, which means loving all that God has created. It's basically, if you're not religious, like it's a way of saying our first dedication is to all of life. Like that's the way that would be talked about outside of a religious, sort of tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one is to love your neighbor, what you love for yourself. And what's the first thing we love? It's being respected and honored as a person and being supported in community to be all that we can be, have our basic needs met. And Islam, for 1.8 billion people, kind of guides them in that direction. But what has happened is that in certain countries where human rights have not been respected, largely because of colonial and neocolonial activities on the part of the United States and European countries, where there's autocratic rule. And what do autocrats love to do? They love to quote scripture, and they love to justify their violence against everyday people on the basis of whatever tradition is there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we end up saying, well, see, the reason that those people are oppressed is because of Islam. No, the reason that they're oppressed is because their entire country was taken over by people who wanted to exploit natural resources, keep people oppressed, keep them without their educations. And then we end up blaming the one thing that has actually kept a lot of people in those countries, sort of with their heads up, which is the idea that there is a God who loves them and who they're called to love, and they're still called to love their neighbor, and they're even called to love their enemy, which the Quran states explicitly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people on the progressive end of things like tend to be upset about the whole religion thing, about women, but also about people forcing their religion on each other. And mm-hmm. The Quran explicitly says, hey, don't do that.
Yeah. Well, the last thing I'm going to ask you is the last thing I ask a lot of people. Because things are, we know things are kind of bleak right now in a lot of ways.
They are.
If you look at this issue, we can see how, Representative Ilhan Omar's been treated, others in visible positions like her, and then people who aren't visible. But what is giving you hope in these times in your work or in general?
Well, I think I do agree that the operative kind of stance toward the time right now is either denial or despair. I think those two are kind of expressions of the same thing. You know, there's nothing that can be done. You know, my faith tradition, you know, encourages me to trust that there is a brighter future. It also teaches me that in times of incredible oppression, it's really important for people of good faith and goodwill to stand up. You know, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all began in times when there was oppression. You know, in Egypt, for our Jewish neighbors, under Roman occupation in the first century, and under a really kind of an oppressive economic and kind of spiritual system in Mecca. And so there's something about my tradition that teaches me, like, when you're feeling that kind of depth of despair, like, that's the time to act.
Mm-hmm.
But the other, so to be contrarian in that sense, right? Notice your despair and then act differently, even though you don't have much to show for it yet. And there are moments, I will say, Taylor, when it's been, like, tough. Like I say August was a real down month for me. Just like, I've been doing all this. I've done, like, 275 of these kind of speaking engagements, you know, like, what difference is this making, you know? And then I went out to an event, and I saw, like, a fearful person, like, give up some of her fear. And she hugged a Muslim woman, you know,
mm-hmm.
And I saw that and I got teary, you know, and if we can keep spreading those positive stories, you know, telling positive stories about all the people who serve as doctors in this country who are Muslim, of people of faith and non-faith traditions getting together and supporting each other. I think that the ripple effect of all those stories together will help us remember ourselves as human beings.
Awesome.
You know, and even if I don't see results of that right now, like, I trust that those results will come even if I don't get to see it.
Awesome. Well, if people listening here at the end want to have some of this experience, want to see the Faith Over Fear Roadshow here in Spokane, you can go to the Wolf Auditorium at Gonzaga University Thursday the 3rd at 6 p.m. from 6 to 8. You've been listening to this interview with Pastor Terry Kylo, who will be talking with Anila. Can you remind me her last name? I closed my notes.
Anila Astali.
Perfect. Thank you. The two of them will be speaking on Thursday. If you missed any part of the show and you want to hear it, I will be podcasting it tonight. You can find that link at kyrs.org/show/praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S. That's all the time we have, Terry. I could talk to you about this for a long time, I think.
Taylor, thank you so much. It's been great conversing with you.
Great. And hopefully we'll see you on Thursday night.
I hope so, too. Thank you.
So again, if you just joined us at the end, you can find all those details for the show. About the interview that you might have missed on the show that will be podcast tonight. You can also email me at praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, at kyrs.org about any shows, past, present, and future. So thanks so much for listening, and you're listening to KYRS. Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.